The following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Bottle of wine. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about their addiction to drugs and alcohol. Linda, what do you have in the news today?
Oh, I have a great one. Is this a real story? Perhaps one of the craziest drug arrests on record. Brazilian police took a parrot into custody after he was believed to be conspiring with his drug-dealing owner, who had been busted twice before. When police arrived for the drug raid, the parrot repeatedly said, "Mummy, police, mummy, police." Although the warning calls were loud and clear during the wild drug bust, no matter how many crackers they offered the parrot, further interrogation, the bird remained silent. The parrot will live out the remainder of his days behind bars at the Teresina Zoo.
You think that's true?
Yeah, I think it's true.
I do, too. It has to be true. Right, Frank?
It's got to be.
Absolutely.
Be.
I got one for you. City of the Walking Dead. Junkies, I don't like that word, but this is the headlines from the New York Post. Junkies shoot up in broad daylight in Midtown. So the Garma District, which is just what it says, it's a district in Manhattan that it primarily is devoted to the manufacturing and selling of clothing, is the newest shooting gallery. A disturbing heroin hotspot of addicts booting up in broad daylight. I guess the point of this is that every major city has a street or an area like that. In Philadelphia, we have the Kensington area. In New York, we have the Garma District. And if anybody around the country can chime in and tell us in their cities what district is that has these poor, unfortunate people living a life of absolute horror.
I know a young couple in New York who just moved into the gentrified Lower East Side, into a beautiful brownstone, and when they come out in the morning, they're tripping over these guys shooting drugs, so now they have to look for another place. And you know how expensive it is in Manhattan.
Yeah.
So it's all over Manhattan. It's not just the Garment District.
Yeah.
It's everywhere.
I mean, it's just so frustrating that the cities can't do something about this. And I really believe, you know, with the right amount of money, this problem can be at least lessened in a congested area.
Exactly.
Which what you just said is horrible for walks of life, for
right.
real estate values, for everything else. LSD is making a comeback among young Americans. If you think hallucinogenics like LSD are a thing of the past, think again. According to the results, hallucinogenics use is a growing public health concern, warranting prevention strategies given the growth risk of unsupervised use, said a lead researcher, Dr. Orphy Levine. He is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of – I can't even pronounce it – at the Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York. So, you know, I did think, hey, Frank, in the old days, you know, magic mushrooms, all that stuff, I did think it was pretty much gone.
Mushrooms are back big time. Right, Frank?
I'm amazed. I haven't been shopping for those in a long time.
It's been a long time.
But, yeah, I'm surprised. I'm surprised it's making a comeback now because it was, you know, it was a sort of niche, at least when I remember it, a sort of niche thing. Not a lot of people were doing it.
Well, it's all illegal. I mean, there's no prescriptions for it or anything like that. We're going to take our first break. When we come back, we're hoping that our audience will come become involved with the show. We're going to talk about all aspects of addiction and recovery, your thoughts, your suggestions, and all that kind of stuff. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campus in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
Hi, this is Butch Patrick. That's right. TV's Eddie Munster, and everything is better with Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, we're back. And you heard the number, everybody, so give us a call. You know, I thought today we'd have an open discussion. You know, there's a lot of myths about this program, a lot of truths, a lot of untruths. Can you think of something you hear all the time about this program that is not true?
Oh, people say it's a cult. People say we're recruiting them to love Jesus. People say all kinds of things. And if you really read the literature, it's about surrender. It's not about believing in a different being. And you can find every excuse not to surrender and find acceptance. But if you find acceptance, you won't say, oh, this isn't for me. You know, when I first came in and I had to say the Lord's Prayer, and I'm Jewish, somebody gave me the 12 steps for Jewish people and this and that. So there are atheists that go to meetings who complain. But, you know, you don't have to participate. There's a famous atheist in one of our groups, and he just doesn't hold hands during the prayer. And now that works out because nobody holds hands because of disease. So now nobody holds hands anymore. But so many people are like, it's a cult, and you're going to make me do things I don't want to do. And in reality, it's just about acceptance. What do you think, Frank?
Yeah. Well, when I first came in, I was in for a couple of years, and I'll never forget this girl who was fighting a heroin addiction came in. And she said, I didn't think, I'm sorry to be here, Jews don't have a heroin addiction. And I thought that was so bizarre to me that she thought that it was only one person or only one type of person that has these addictions. And so there's a lot of misconceptions when you come in. I agree with acceptance, certainly, but I also agree with surrender, too, because, you know, I had to, when I was first coming in, I thought I knew it all. I thought I had this under control, and I didn't, obviously. And I had to take suggestions from people, and that was a little foreign to me, too. So it's those kinds of things.
If you're just joining us now, I'm with Linda and Frankie B. And we're just talking about all aspects of addiction and recovery. And I would just like to mention, if you're listening and you want to watch us do this show live, just go to Facebook, to Clean and Sober radio page at 3 o'clock. Any Friday, and you can watch us do the show. It's actually a lot of fun to watch, and you know, it makes it a little more interesting. So you know, when I asked you about the myth, I knew you were going to say that. And I thought that was the first thing that came to my mind. I think more things are true about the program, but you know, it's not. You know, once you get into and make a decision to get into recovery, it's not all peaches and cream.
Right.
You still have a lot of adversities you have to overcome, especially if you have charges that haven't been resolved, mm-hmm. or you have a bad family life, you know, bad wife, bad husband. So, you know, somebody said to me this week, what is a pink cloud? What does that mean? And, you know, that pink cloud, I think we all experienced. You know, you got into recovery and it was like, this is the greatest thing. I'm like in Disneyland now and it's never going to end. Mm-hmm. Well, I remember for me, the pink cloud ended 2 years after I got sober and I was arrested for something that happened 2 years before. So, look, you make the best of it. It is a great program. You know, the generalization of it, it's a great program that's kept so many people sober. But you have to pick and choose what you want to hear and what you don't want to hear.
Exactly. And, you know, there are plenty of people willing to sponsor you. And if you don't like the first person you pick another one. None of us get insulted. Not everybody is for everybody. We like to say men for men and women for women, but sometimes we have to mix it up.
Yeah. That's also, I think, true for meetings.
Yes.
Okay. You know, you can't love everybody and you can't love everybody in this program. So if you find a meeting that you don't like, go to another one. You'll definitely find a meeting that you like.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely true.
Right?
Absolutely. I've been to meetings that I love.
Yeah.
You know, and I called the home group for a long time. And then somebody took me to a meeting and I was not that great, not for me.
Right.
I was going to say before when you were talking about the pink cloud, money is a big, big cloud, you know, a big thing that you burst the pink cloud when you think of, oh, I'm great, I'm getting clean and sober, and then you have money problems, family problems, that sort of bursts your pink cloud real quick,
yeah.
You know?
And I think you have to be careful, Frank, that not you, but, you know, we come into recovery, you want to tell everybody, hey, look how great I am,
right.
And there's people who don't want to hear it.
Right.
Even to this day, we were talking about that the other day. Even to this day, I just spoke to a guy that I knew when I was out there, and I called him to try to rekindle what we had before, and he didn't want any part of it. He was like, you were real bad when you were out there, and now, you know, and I said, I've got 25 years now.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, I'm clean and sober. And he just didn't want to hear it. You got that vibe. And I understand how I had a lot of damage. I did a lot of damage.
Hey, you know, we have a lot of people that are, I guess because you two are on the show today, there's a big interest. So I just want to run through a couple of these people. Judge Maddox. Laura Story, for the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I celebrate 13 years. Congratulations, Laura. That is absolutely fantastic because we can remember when we couldn't get 24 hours. Kathy Wolf Collin, Mark Willink is watching, and we hope he's doing better. He's had a little setback. Nikki Casino, hey, y'all. Happy Friday from New Orleans, Louisiana. That's how I say it. New Orleans? Something like that. Anyway. Lucky 13, congratulations. Let's see. Hope Poland Rosenthal. Ronald, I hope I don't butcher this. Linda, you want to butcher this name? I'm sure it's a simple name. No, it's not. You see that name? Try it.
Ronald Cizak.
Oh.
That was the stumper guy.
All right. Nikki Lazarus. Happy Fridays, guys, from Long Island. We love when people say where they're from.
Oh, we love that.
Stephen Sussman.
Hey, Steve.
Hello from Palm Beach. Just returned from a month in Israel.
Wonderful.
Thank you, everybody, for supporting us and watching. And it makes a show, you know, it makes a show great. And also, our new number is 1-888-728-9941. So, let's see what else we got. LSD. There's another article, another news article I wanted to bring up. Florida man strikes again. While not a part of a large-scale drug operation, Florida man made national news this year as police confiscated two bags of drugs neatly labeled bags full of drugs. Smart. Two men were pulled over for a routine traffic stop, but ultimately the stop resulted in the confiscation of several types of illicit drugs with an estimated street value of $15,000. Unfortunately, this is not the first Florida man drug story, and it certainly won't be the last. You know, I thought I was a pretty smart dealer. not an actual dealer, but I like to help people out back then. I would consider myself smarter than people like this.
Right.
You too. Come on. Yeah. Linda, did you sell drugs?
I have to say I did.
Okay, but you were smart, right?
Well, it was very funny because I made a deal with a guy I knew, and he was convinced that certain people were out to get him. So we had to follow him all over Brooklyn before he would stop to make sure nobody was following us and all this. So we get everything from him. And my boyfriend at the time was the one who made the deal. And he says, oh, let's go over to this guy's house and we'll give it to him. We'll meet his wife, whatever. We go over there, and it was one of my ex-boyfriends, but he didn't know that. So we leave everything off. And then I get home, 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone's ringing. The guy that we sold to is screaming at me that he's missing something. And I said, I'll never do this again. I will never do this again. So he was screaming at me, give me money or come back with another one. I'm like, I made one deal. I don't have anything. But it's frightening. It's scary. Like, I don't have the constitution for doing that. I did that one time, and that was too much.
You have to know your strengths.
Right.
Right? And your weaknesses. Frank, what about you?
Ooh, don't even go there with
oh,
me.
Oh, Frank.
Frank, we only have 45 minutes.
He was a regular. He was.
Don't even go there. I was, yeah.
All right.
I had my little deals in the day.
Okay.
Okay? But I never, I'll say this, I never labeled bag full of drugs.
Right, right.
That I think, was a no-no, even back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, you hear these stories that they're absolutely, ridiculous. Here's a question for you. Environmental or genetic, which is it, or is it both that caused our addictions? What do you think?
Oh, it's genetic first, because you can have somebody in your family who has the genetic predisposition, but for some reason they're not attracted to doing it, and they never become the addict. And the brother or sister of that person with the same genes starts like we started and we couldn't stop. So, I mean, I have, 5 half-sisters and brothers, and none of them have this problem. So it's very – but then once you're in the environment and doing it, then you're out there. Then you're done. So there are some people who've never tried it, never got out of control, and they may have the predisposition, but they don't act on it. And once we act on it, we're gone.
So is it a dominant gene?
There is a gene. They've named it. I can't remember what it is, but there is a gene.
Right, because you do hear that a lot. Look, our buddies, David and Stephen Sussman, twins. And, David became an addict, but, before he passed, he did very, very well, and Stephen didn't. So I guess they probably had the same predisposition, but one
acted on it and went to the race. I think it depends what happens when you drink or use for the first time. If you find it euphoric and want to continue, and more is never enough. There's never enough for us.
Yeah, I have a. It's weird that you say that, Linda, because my father and mother never picked up a drink.
Right.
And I didn't. I picked up a pot. Late, I consider it late. It was 18.
Okay.
And so I can almost trace the first time I had that euphoric high that I said, this is it, I'm off to the races. And then it built and built and built. But I've always wondered that, whether it's genetic or environment. I was put into that environment in college where everybody was doing it. And it made me more than what I was before. So I always struggle with that. But I've come to the realization that everything could be an addiction now.
Yes.
You can be addicted. If you have this gene, you can be addicted to cheese, and you'll carry that through. It just so happened that I was thrust into the 70s and early 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. They say disease, addiction's a brain disease. I really don't know if anybody actually knows the questions I'm asking. They know the answers. Do they really? The amount of information that people know about the brain is probably minuscule. And I think that, you know, it's easy to say it's a brain disease. It's easy to say, you know, you're born that way. Or, you know, it's easy to say. I personally think it's the main part for me was environmental. But then I say to myself, why was I the type that was so attracted to that for so long? Mm-hmm. Where a lot of people aren't. I'd like to really, you know, it's interesting to I don't know if we'll ever find the answers to that.
And one of the things that people who don't have the problem, and I'm sure there's some people listening, family members and so forth, that don't have it, is that after we have that first feeling of euphoria, whatever you want to call it, we're chasing that all the time to get that first feeling back, and we need more and more and more and more, and we can never get there. So we're dissatisfied with our use even after that.
Yeah, we're disappointed even in our addiction,
right?
We're disappointed.
Many times we were disappointed.
Many times. Many times. Hey, Frank, I have somebody who said something to you. John Logue, Frank Brightman, no way.
Way.
What's that?
Way.
Way.
What's that mean?
He's probably shocked that I know you, Gary.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. That's what it is.
Edmund Anthony IV is watching. Let's see what else. I don't want to miss anybody. Well, we'll get back. There's a lot of people out there. You know. Anyway. You know, that's actually an interesting concept I just came up with. We were disappointed in our addiction.
Mm-hmm.
We're disappointed in everything, even our addiction. What do you make of that?
Yeah. We're always looking for something else.
And we were disappointed in the way it affected others. I mean, there's a million different disappointments we had, you know. It wasn't all good times.
Not at all.
You know, it wasn't at all good times when we look back on it.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty bizarre why we did it. You know, that we wanted to be better. We wanted to feel better. But it turned out we destroyed a lot of stuff. You know?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't think I really cared what others thought back then. Now I care what I did. But I didn't care back then. It was all about me.
Yeah, but I had pangs of guilt.
Oh, okay.
I did. I think I did, you know.
You have a conscience.
Yeah, but you know, that's a good point. That is a good point. I was telling somebody today, I had no thoughts about what I did to my family.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Me either.
Never came up in my head, in my sick, twisted head. I didn't care. But then there were times where I felt bad about about myself most of the time. That's why I kept mm-hmm. doing it, you know? Let's do that. Okay. When we come back, let's talk about how others who viewed us or judged us and how that may have made an impact on us getting help finally. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Huntington Creek Recovery Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-2320.
Hey, this is Andy Powell of Wishbone Ash, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
So did we really care what other people thought of us? I mean, was it a determining factor, finally, for us to get help? What was it?
I don't know that it was from the outside. I think it was an inside job that we were finally sick of everything that was going on. It was everything.
Now, some of us were forced to get help because of
right.
the law.
Right.
But, Frank, did you care? Forget your family. Did you care? Any of your friends say to you, hey, man, come on. It's enough?
No.
No.
Because at the end.
Right.
And I've said this many times before.
Yeah.
The friends were either you got some or you want some.
Right.
You know, those were the two friends that I had. So they were more concerned for getting it than about me. I mean, certainly I had friends that were concerned for me, okay? that I felt my best friend, I went to his wedding and I was out of my mind, and I could tell that he was concerned for my health and my, you know, my well-being, and I made a fool of myself, and so I felt bad. And later, after I got clean and sober for a while, he said, "Oh, thank God you're alive." He was that concerned.
You were lucky because somebody would have kicked you to the curb.
And some people did.
Yeah.
And some people did. But the close friends were concerned, and I was – but I wasn't necessarily at that point concerned about them either.
Right.
You know? I did it.
How about you, Linda?
I got together with my high school friends before Facebook. They sort of found me on the internet, my best friend from high school, who I hadn't talked to at that point for like 35 years. And that was exactly what they said, "Thank God you're alive." Like, but my best friend, who they're still friends with and I'm not, she's not on Facebook or anything, they said, "Oh, she doesn't want any part of you." And I was like, what did I ever do to her? And probably I dropped her to go with friends who had different interests. I probably just dropped her like a hot potato, but I don't know why she doesn't talk to me. They're having another reunion because we were going to have our 50th last year, but because of COVID, they canceled it. But I'm probably not going to go.
I had that same reaction. A woman that I met in my home group said she was renting an apartment from this girl. And I said, "Oh, wow, tell her you know, I'm clean, I'm sober. I was at this girl's wedding. I knew her for years before I got clean and sober." She came back and I said, "Did you tell her that I'm clean and sober?" And she said, "Yeah, don't ever speak to her again." And that hurts. But I understood. I must have hurt her. And I tried to say, "I'm sorry." I tried to make amends to her, but she didn't want any part of it. And, you know, there's nothing I could do at that point.
Now, sometimes you make amends and you think you covered everybody.
Yeah.
And I had one guy in the back of my mind forever that I did something bad to. He lived in my building. And one day he hit me up on Facebook like 2 years ago. And he said, "Do you know who I am?" And the first thing I said was, "I know you're a man I owe apology to." And he forgave me instantly. And we're friends. But the other people... not the same. I have another friend I've been with since high school, and we were talking on Facebook, commenting on something. His brother got into it, and his brother started commenting, and I was defending my friend against his brother, and I made some comments about whatever the subject was. Well, his brother apparently has had a grudge against me since 1973. He said, "Do you remember what you did? Do you know the DA had to come talk to me at work? You know, I was so embarrassed by that." And I said, "Well, you didn't get arrested." And so this guy doesn't forgive me since 1973. And I asked his brother, "Should I do anything?" He's like, "No, there's nothing you can do about this."
Yeah, it's interesting about forgiveness. You know, I had, I'm not going to mention any names.
No.
There was a person that I went out with in the early 70s, and then I became crazy. And she didn't want anything to do with me. I tried to reach out a couple times, you know. No. As soon as I got a presidential pardon, a lot of people who wouldn't talk to me, one that reached out to me.
Oh, that's funny.
Sort of sickening in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, come on. What more do we have to do as people in recovery to gain somebody's respect back? Because that was a big issue for me. You know, I have people in my family who would like, you know, pat me on the – not the head, but the shoulder. "Hey, what's Gary doing these days? You know, like – you're garbage."
Mm-hmm.
So the respect thing for me was a big issue. And I think the three of us, we've been around long enough, I think we've gained all that stuff back. But it hurts when somebody still won't let up on it.
You have to just walk away. You know, that's acceptance. I have to accept that person remembers the old me, not the new me. One of my brothers posted that just the other day, that there are half the people remember you from 25 and younger, and they're stuck at that image of you from 25 and younger. And the rest of the people that know you now can't believe you were like that before, and vice versa, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's But that except, you know, it's almost like, why do I care with this person who, you know, wouldn't talk to me for 10 years? Why do I care what they think of me? I mean, that's probably, you know, when you point your finger at somebody and it's three pointing back,
mm-hmm.
It's like, but there's something I guess I need, or I need to prove that, hey, I'm okay now.
Yeah, we all want to be liked.
Yeah.
I think that's it. And, you know, we're hurt when we're not liked by someone. But,
We're sensitive. I think a lot of us are sensitive.
Overly sensitive.
Overly.
We are.
And that's a trait of addicts.
Yeah.
You know, we're very, very sensitive. And you have to, I think you have to compensate for that. When you talk to an addict, you have to be, or someone in the program, let's say, you have to be cognizant of the fact that they're hypersensitive almost.
Yes.
About, especially about the way they were then and the way they are now.
Yeah. I think this is a new listener. My addiction was terrible in my last days. Police cells, double. No, he can't mean that. Blessed to be grateful and 20 years in November.
Wonderful.
Nancy Minnick sends us a note. Hi, guys. Thanks for the frank conversation. I think it is helpful to people. They can see your human side. Yeah, we are. Listen, I don't care who you are, what you got. We are human if we're honest with ourselves. Right?
And we will help anybody. We don't
yeah.
care what you're addicted to.
Yeah.
We will help anybody. So please call us. Please have your friends call us. We're here to help other people because we got better.
And right. And this leads into, if you need help now, call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. That's a real number. The real people are going to answer the phone. And you can get – and you there's help out there.
Absolutely.
There's help out there. And it's scary to go get it. But there's no drive-thrus. And there is no delivery services, as we say, but there is help out there, you know.
Absolutely.
And you have to know where to get it. That's the thing. I think we touched on it last week.
Well, you have to think of it also.
Right.
You have to want it, and you have to think of it. You know, a lot of times in my addiction, I didn't – while I knew there was help out there, it had to be drilled into my head, you know, that – there is help, and call and do it now. You know?
Yeah.
Or else it continues. You get on that treadmill again.
And that is...
But is it the only disease in the world that you have to want to get better? That if you don't want to get it, you're never going to get it.
Well,
but when somebody gets cancer, you don't say to them, do you want to get better? Do you really want this? They only say that to addicts.
That's a good point. Because they think it's your fault.
Of course, right.
It's ridiculous. It's your fault. Nothing else is your fault except, you know, any disease. But this is, you know, you remember Nancy Reagan, just say no. It's so easy to stop. Which is
we often say, you go to the hospital and you have diabetes, a heart attack, pneumonia, whatever you have. They're going to say, okay, we'll check you in. Drug addiction? Let's wait 3 days for a bed. Let's wait for the right insurance. Let's wait for somebody to sponsor you. Call this number to get a scholarship. We don't just check them in. It's a big hassle.
It's terrible.
But you can go to any meeting on any corner of Philadelphia. We have like 400 meetings a day in the area, and anybody will help you for free as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, any city, any country.
Anywhere.
Anywhere. That's a beautiful thing.
Any person in recovery
right.
will help you.
Anybody.
Yeah. It is amazing. You can go to any city, any country, and immediately have a bond with people.
Oh, pretty I cool. love that. Don't you love that when you're traveling and
yeah.
you run into a meeting in a foreign
have
country?
Have you been?
I've been to the American speaking meeting in Paris. I've been to meetings in Barbados was my favorite meeting that I went to.
Really? I was in the meeting in Paris also.
I love that meeting.
Yeah.
And, I was meeting some. But Barbados had to be my favorite. It was in the yard, the courtyard of a church.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just, the people were so warm, so nice. I drove myself there in one of those Jeep things. And I got attacked by dogs on the way. And I found it in the dark. And
yeah, how did you find a meeting in the Caribbean? How did you
I don't
do
remember back then because there were no cell phones when I went to Barbados. It was, had to be early 90s. And, yeah, it was – I found it.
Frank, you ever been to a foreign country?
Sure,
to a
sure.
To a meeting?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
Thanks for the clarification.
Yeah, okay. All right, okay.
Yeah, I was at a meeting in Budapest.
Oh, nice. Oh.
It was really nice. Yep. And a really great meeting in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Oh, I'm dying to go to Oaxaca.
That we found, and it was a great meeting. Those were my two favorites, I think, Budapest, because there was only like one other person that spoke English.
Oh, nice.
And he was a great guy, and we were asking questions about how it was. But Hungarian's not my language.
Not your first language.
So it was. I've been to several meetings in foreign countries and in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's part of the journey.
You know, I thought about the people in the Ukraine, and obviously there's addiction everywhere. And how do these poor folks, besides everything else that's horrific going on there, how do they deal with this? I wonder if there's still meetings. You know, a layperson wouldn't think of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, but because meetings are so important, you know, I wonder if they still have the opportunity to get to them.
I'm sure they have people who help other addicts,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it doesn't have to be a formal
meeting.
And in
person, it could be Zoom.
Yep. Okay, I got another funny news story for you, all right? I don't know how funny this is, but it's... Shrooms, read all about it, okay? I guess anybody that's listening or watching understands what shrooms mean. They're mushrooms, all right? I'll clarify that. While mum's the word for many drug dealers, not everyone can keep their mouth shut. A Denver man's apartment was raided after suspicions that he was illegally selling psychedelic mushrooms. The kicker is that the man likely ratted himself out. Although psychedelic mushrooms are now legal in the Mile High City, their sale and distribution by average citizens is not. Instead of keeping his business operation quiet, Cole Milner did interviews with various news sites that ultimately led to discovery of his real identity. So there's another moron who is advertising his illegal activities.
I told Cole not to do that.
You did tell him?
Don't talk to anybody.
No. Really? Keep it quiet.
Keep it quiet.
Well, there's a lot of confusion about the things that are legal. And, you know, in Denver, for one, you can pretty much get anything legally. But L.A., if you see the story about L.A., that they have the distribution centers, but the dealers that wanted to get the licenses for the legal places couldn't get them. So they operate in a district right behind the legal ones. And the legal ones are like losing money, I heard, because there's so much back dealing going on. So
I didn't even know you could get psilocybin or mushrooms or anything in Denver.
Denver, you can get
it. I thought it was Oregon.
Here.
It's in Denver.
Yeah,
Denver too.
Yeah. Hey guys, everybody here has kids. I'm assuming. Did your kids ever see you high? Either one of you?
No.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Okay, that was a ridiculous question.
why was it ridiculous? Because
no, I'm teasing with you. That wasn't even a motivation, was it?
No, that's a regret,
mm-hmm.
you know, in sobriety. My kids are in their 30s now.
Right.
So we have discussions about it. You know, they congratulate me on my anniversary, you know. But it's a sore point. It's in my mind,
yeah.
It's a sore point.
Yeah.
My oldest is 36, and he bore the brunt of it because he was with it the longest.
Mm-hmm. Regrets are hard to talk about, and you know they're hard to get rid of. No matter how much time has passed on this particular subject of, I'm not saying there's abuse, but it is kind of abuse to your kids. But it's not, you know, hitting them or anything like that. It's what they encountered, and you know regrets. How do you make good a regret? I mean, how do you do that?
You do the best you can. You do the best you can. I mean, hopefully, when I get clean and sober, my relationship changed with my kids. And so hopefully I tried to make up for it, and they understand that. You know, I didn't go to prison. I didn't go to away. I didn't go, you know, I didn't totally ignore them, and I provided for my family. So it was when they were there, I was in recovery. I was there for them. And I tried to know that.
Did you ever talk to them about it? Or is all it the so, time. It's, if it's, I mean, now it's sort of all, easy, right?
All
I mean,
the time. Well, they bring it up when they want to put a dig
give it
on
to you,
me.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But they know that, you know, that it was a hard thing to do. And that they will, you know, that I regret what I did. But
yeah, there's nothing you can do except do the right stuff. And Linda,
right.
Nothing, right? Your kids never saw you?
Well, when I had that relapse 11 years ago, I was kind of just in bed all the time. And it took a long time. I had to make amends to him. And, you know, he's in the program. So these young kids take it all really seriously. They have the big book sponsor or this sponsor or that. Anyway, I did my amends. And afterwards, he said, isn't there anything else? And I said, well, tell me what else, you know, you wanted. And he told me a few things. And I said, oh, my God, I didn't even realize that. Like, you don't even know what your family's thinking, especially if you're in bed all the time. You know, I was, you know, it was pretty bad. So, yeah, he didn't see me high drinking or anything. But this was, you know, that pill addiction from after my surgery. And it was not pleasant for anybody. And it took him a long time to come around because he grew up in a sober household. And I think that kind of saved his life from not going off the deep end, you know. So I kind of think that helped, that he fell right into the life when he decided to get ready. But in the meantime, my failure 11 years ago didn't really sit too well with him.
You know, regrets can obviously, it's more than just your family members. Can you, either one of you, think of another monumental regret directly caused by your addiction that you want to talk about? No, Frank? How about you, Linda?
I'm thinking.
Hey, listen, that's good. That's good.
I'm trying to think of one, Gary.
All right, well, you think about Linda.
Okay.
Linda, take it.
I can't think of one either.
That's pretty good.
When you've done the whole program and you did all the amends and you did all the steps like 20 times like we did, like that stuff is all acceptance.
I guess the most monumental regret is what a waste of time it was.
And money.
You know? Monumental waste of time. That I could have been, you know, my drug of choice was cocaine. And, you know, there ain't much. It was a waste of time at 3 o'clock in the morning to like be real high and not, you know, it was just a whole waste of time and that I can never get back. And that, I guess, is the monumental regret.
Yeah.
Because when I got clean and sober, I always wanted to travel. I always wanted to be with my kids and be with the family because my father had done that. He was a sort of a workaholic, and I didn't get to see him for a lot of my life, and he passed away early. So that's the monumental regret I guess I can.
Linda, what about, can you think of one?
I could have had a much more productive life.
Yeah, I think.
I went to school and I would take two classes here and drop out. And I finally graduated from school in 2005, got my bachelor's. And that was probably the longest period ever from 73 to 2005. But then I turned around and went right back and got a master's. And you know, now I have a good career. But you know, I could have been doing this much younger.
Well, it's the time factor. Listen, if you're contemplating getting clean, what were the things that you feared that you would miss the most? Let's discuss that when we come back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Diversity in the workplace is more than gender, ethnicity, and even age. It also means people in recovery. The Higher Calling Foundation works to end the stigma of substance use disorders in the workplace by helping those in recovery find jobs, get career counseling, and more. All things insurance doesn't cover, and all at no cost. And encouraging businesses to hire employees in recovery. Because with the Great Resignation, there are jobs to be filled, and employees in recovery are an untapped demographic. It's mutually beneficial, and it's simply good business. Started by employment attorney in recovery Kevin Heyer, the Higher Calling Foundation believes everyone deserves a second chance and works to make that happen. And now, diversity in the workplace demands it. Visit HireCalling.org. That's H-Y-E-R calling.org. And find out how we can help you.
Hey, this is Darryl Strawberry, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
All right, so what did you guys think you were going to miss, you know, getting clean?
Well, that partying.
Partying?
Yeah. I mean, I was out every night.
Well, sort of at the end of it, I wasn't partying anymore.
Right.
I was in my basement alone. And so I guess if you're asking me what I miss, what I think I would miss, it was the trips to the state store to come down and things like that.
Wow.
I'm not sure that's a miss.
That is.
I still, you know, even in recovery, there are times that I tell this story that when my kid was in college, when one of my sons was in college, he said he was a member of a frat, and he said, why don't you stay, Dad? All the fathers are getting together. We're having, we're doing a beer pong.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, you know, obviously I couldn't do that. And, but it was, again, because I wanted to spend time with my son, you know, to make up for what I did, you know, when I was out there.
I think that I missed, that I, what I feared I would miss is feeling better than I will feel if I don't get, if I don't get doped up. I was afraid of how I would feel if I didn't have the opportunity to get high.
You missed the high.
I missed the high.
Yeah.
Totally missed the high. And I also feared that if I got clean and sober, I would have to become productive, like get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And that terrified me because, you know, the longer you go without really working and all your friends are passing you by and all this is going on, the harder it is to get going. And that was my fear, that I would have to become productive. And that I would miss – I mean, it was sort of a contradiction, but I missed – I was going to miss getting – feeling great, and I was afraid of what I would now have to do. All right, now you're sober. Now you got to do this. That was a fear, you know? Let me hit a couple of these people up here. Brian Martin, I love these. All these people are watching us. Linda Sterlazzi, Ann Butler Hickson, Dan Quinn, Deborah Snyderman Narcisse, and John Logue. Same regret, time wasted. I think that is a big one. You know, the time that we wasted. Warren Crispell, Ron Lee Tung. Yeah, the time. That's the one thing we can't get back. Time. But you know what? Then you can start rationalizing everything. Well, if I was able to do this, you know, if I was able to be the senator of the United States, maybe to getting to work, I'd be run over by a bus. You know, you can make up anything. You can, you know, trick yourself or rationalize anything. But I think time is a big regret.
It was that I didn't have any feelings. I didn't feel anything because I was busy getting high and covering up the feelings. So when I got sober the first time, they said, don't do anything drastic for the first year. Don't make any big decisions. Don't have a boyfriend. So, of course, I did everything I wasn't supposed to do. Yeah. 9 months sober, I bought a house. And when the people called to say I was approved for the mortgage, you know, I had been such a loser. And I had maybe 20, 30 jobs by then. I was 30 years old when I got sober. And I was shaking and crying when they called to approve the mortgage. Sure. A good stress, bad stress, you have the same reaction. I was so stressed, I had to lay down on the couch so that I wouldn't get too excited. But I tell people that story all the time. Like, good stress and bad stress do the same thing, but I didn't know what it was like to feel anything. So feeling that was amazing. And luckily, I was new in the program, and I had sponsors and, you know, all that. The boyfriends, I kind of had to have a boyfriend. I couldn't go without. But
you know, it is overwhelming when you are first recognized that you're worthy enough to have things.
Yeah.
That you know, because of such low self-esteem, at least that I had, you weren't worthy of anything. Mm-hmm. So for somebody to give you your first mortgage, wow.
It was a big deal.
It's a big deal.
Well, I had just gone through a divorce, and that was a big factor in why I got, because now I was by myself. I was divorced. I was in a little apartment by myself. I was now drinking by myself like you were, and it was a very difficult period. So coming out of it and buying a house and doing all that stuff was just great. But it was scary. I was really frightened.
I was frightened when I got clean and sober. I was frightened of the basement. Because
that's where you did your dirty work.
Right. Everything, you
know? So you didn't go back down there?
For a good 2 years.
Wow.
It was crazy. And finally, I went down there. And even just seeing it again after that was scary. Because you don't know what I left behind,
mm-hmm.
You know? That was, it's a little weird, but it happened. You know, it's like people, places, and things. There were places I couldn't go in Philadelphia because I know my car would probably gravitate to that, you know, that person's house.
And, you know, we're lucky that we recognize our limitations, people, places, and things. You know, a lot of times you hear people, you know, usually newcomers or fairly new. Oh, yeah, I can go into the bar. You know, I know it's under control. I can, you know, you have to recognize what are the clinics where you have to know your limitations and what you can and can't do. And guess what? Because we're sober, there's a lot of things we can't do. But there's a lot of things we can do that we couldn't do before.
Right. We can really enjoy life now. And if you have to say no to a happy hour meeting, say no to it and offer a breakfast meeting. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me see if there's one more ridiculous story so we can make everybody laugh before the show's over. Polly wants some drugs. I think the show was we're coming to the hour, and I think this is a good show. You know, I think a lot of people who you know responded said that you know they like you know it's nice to have famous people on important people, but when we talk, we're regular people. We're in recovery, and that's all we are. We're regular people who finally got it, and we're lucky.
We're really lucky. You know, we're blessed. I feel like I'm blessed to have this program. I just love it.
You do.
And to have friends like you guys for all these years. Oh, my God.
Listen,
we know each other like 38 years.
But we would
not you less, but him, 38 years. I met him in a meeting.
Years.
We would never have known that
never
you guys existed.
Right?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
It's so weird. Like, we wouldn't be in each other's lives. We wouldn't be on Facebook. I wouldn't know what you're up to or what
you'd
Mark
walk,
Willing
we'd
is
walk
up
by
to, right?
each other and not wouldn't say a word.
He made me the greeter at his meeting. The first time I went, a guy brought me to the meeting, and he said, oh, this guy, Gary, he just started this great meeting, blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, you know what? Do me a favor. Nobody knows where this is. You stay by the door, say hello to everybody, and tell them where to go. I was petrified to even do that. I had 9 months. And that fella that night came back to my apartment and first threw out all the liquor I had. I hadn't done that, and I had 9 months clean.
Wow.
And he's like, oh, my God, why do you have all this stuff in your apartment? And he cleans it out for me.
Yeah. Hey, I just want to give a quick last shout-out to Hillary Langsner. I think she's in Florida. Anyway, it was a great show, guys. And remember, if your loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. 1-800-662-HELP. I mean, it's really there. This is not a dead end unless you're dead. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
Linda Elkins.
Frank B.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Everybody is a star.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.